Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hi, folks. How are you? Hope this finds you well. Edith Bowman here. Maybe you didn't, but it's me. Thank you for listening to Soundtrackin' with me, Edith Bowman, my weekly podcast where I talk about film and music and TV and have a lovely conversation with people about those worlds. When you join me, it is Friday morning, the 11th of March, and last night I had the absolute pleasure of hosting a very special Q&A after a screening, a preview screening of Craig Roberts' new film. It's called Phantom of the Open. It's directed by the hilarious and brilliant Simon Farnaby, who a lot of you will know from many things, Horrible Histories being one of them, Paddington as well. And it's this true story based on this real person who's called Maurice Flitcroft. And he worked as a crane operator in a shipyard in Barrow-on-Furness in the 70s. And he managed to get himself a place in the Open Golf Championships, having never played a round of golf. Maurice is played by none other than Mark Rylance. And if you are a regular listener to the show, you'll have heard me talk about Craig a number of times. He last appeared on the show, episode 214, back in November 2020, talking about his the last film that he made, Eternal Beauty. There was based on a relative of his, played by the brilliant Sally Hawkins. Craig is brilliant. This new film, Phantom of the Open, is only his third film that he's directed. And I'm so excited about his journey as a filmmaker and just really excited about where he goes. He's going to be our guest in a couple of weeks. I'm going to chat to him this coming week, along with his composer for Phantom of the Open, Isabel Waller-Bridge. So we've got them together. That's coming up in a couple of weeks. But I wanted to talk to you about it very quickly before this week's episode for two reasons. One is that it is going to be in cinemas a week today. So the 18th of March, Phantom of the Open is out. It's not about golf. Obviously, golf features in it, but don't be put off by going, oh, I hate golf. Golf is not really an important factor here. It's just a backdrop and a colour wash of the film. But go and see it because it's so brilliant on so many levels. Mark Rylance will melt your heart. He is so great in this. And I was so blown away last night because the Q&A was only supposed to be with Simon and Craig. And we were very lucky that Mark came along to support the film and was more than happy to get involved in the Q&A. And it's the first time that I've had the chance to interview him. And he was everything that you want him to be. What a legend. Oh, what a man. So Craig is going to be on the show in a couple of weeks. And he has a big connection with this week's guest because he is a huge fan of this person. So much so that last night I couldn't wait to show off my picture of myself with this week's guest. And he was like, no way. So yeah, because I can't believe that. I mean, I can't believe the run of guests that we've had recently actually on Soundtrack. And it's pretty crazy. I'm so lucky with the guests that agreed to come and give us their time on the show. And the last couple of weeks has been bonkers. Andrew Garfield, Dave Grohl, Johnny Greenwood. It's been quite insane. But when it comes to marrying music and film, PTA, Paul Thomas Anderson, is, I think, right up there with the likes of Scorsese and Tarantino as a master of the art. His latest movie, Licorice Pizza, is not only a delight to behold, but also chock full of needle drops, including this one, Peace Frog by the Doors. Dead blood in the streets, it's up to my ankles. Sheep blood in the streets, it's up to my knee. Sheep blood in the street, the town of Chicago. Sheep blood on the rise, it's following me.
Listen, I'm so excited to have you on the podcast. I spoke to Mr. Johnny Greenwood last week.
What nonsense was he spouting? Let's hear this.
Well, I mean, one of my main come away from speaking to Johnny was meeting Stephen Bennett, who is his cello that he used, which he used for, not your film.
Power of the Dog.
Yeah. And he had him and he brought him out to show me him. And I loved that he'd, and I was like, I love that you named your cello. He went, no, he came with his name. And there's this whole story about him being a kid, you know, secondhand cello with a kid's name in it. And it was like, oh my God, I love that so much. And that you call him by his name. It's brilliant. Anyway, we're not going to talk about, well, we will talk about Johnny Greenwood a bit.
That's actually a good short film, a call me by your name kind of sequel with Johnny and his cello.
Yeah. What, trying to think what the peach scene would be for that.
I'll have to come up with a few things. Are we rolling? Is this
Oh, I've started here. Yeah.
All right.
Let's start. Can we start at Licorice Pizza? Because trying to think about where to start with you with music was kind of quite tricky, to be honest, because there is so much to talk about. Because every film has such a gorgeous relationship with music and a specific relationship to music with music for narrative, for character, for mood, for location, all that kind of thing. And I think with Licorice Pizza, for me, it felt like, you know, we come in and that kind of first thing we hear is that Nina Simone track.
Yeah.
Which we hear the whole track as well, which I love.
Yeah.
It's almost like a music video.
Yeah.
Did you know how you wanted the film to sound? I mean, did you want it to sound like the San Fernando Valley? What was the kind of...
Well, that certainly doesn't sound like the San Fernando Valley. But by the way, I think we hear that song like almost 2.5 times. Yeah, we loop the middle section, I think, twice.
Great.
So we extend it out. I mean, and
it's the remix version.
It is the remix version. Yeah. Luckily, there's a lot of dialogue going on, so you kind of don't notice.
Yeah.
But she sings things a few more times than she should. But, I mean, when is too much of her, you know?
Yeah.
It's never enough.
True love seed in the autumn ground. True love seed in the autumn ground. When will it be found? True love deep in the winter white snow. True love deep in the winter white snow. How long will it take to grow? You know true love buds in the April air, the April air. Was there ever a bud so fair?
I cannot really put my finger on the memory of when that came to me. It didn't come to me. I think I was pretty far into writing the movie, maybe even had written it, and a song that I should know, which I didn't know, which I heard, I believe, on the radio, was like, "Huh, I just got a gift. Listen to this, you know, and this could really work." The greatest trick there was, for some reason, this feels right? It just feels right in its tone and its texture. It has absolutely nothing to do with the period or with the San Fernando Valley, but it has to do with the story. And then I can see Alana swaying and walking to that rhythm, right? To that beat. So that I knew was a winner. The challenge was always going to be, is anybody going to be listening to your main character speaking when Nina Simone is singing?
Yeah.
Right? Because that, you only want to listen to her sing. And that really is a challenge. And I think it became a mixed thing. I think you have to allow enough of her to sing that first verse.
Yeah.
Right. And that visually enough happens that you can kind of hand off her singing to the main character.
Yeah, she almost passes the baton to them.
She passes it off, exactly. Baton? You mean baton? God, speak English, Edith.
I'm Scottish.
No, I know. Come on. I will not do this interview
thing.
In Scottish. I will only do this interview
in English. But I think that's so clever because she's kind of like, come on. And then you're watching them and you want to know where it goes. You want to know where their conversation goes.
Yeah. I think that's true. And I think there's enough sort of musical passages, you know, without her singing that it can, we sort of mix it in and out. And the beautiful part is that by the end of that opening scene, there's room for Nina Simone to come back through for the final couple lyrics that can kind of come up on the soundtrack and sort of be more present, just like it's as it started.
This is your home, this area that your film's set in. But did you have very clear ideas of specific things you wanted to include in it that really highlighted the feeling, the emotion, the era of that area at that time?
Yes and no. I didn't really have the one thing I'm thinking of is that I'm thinking right now of the Chico Hamilton cue, which I had this bet with my gaffer, Mike Bauman, who we shoot with. Four films now, we've watched dailies. When we watch dailies, we always play music. And I've been trying to get in this Blue Sands by Chico Hamilton. And every time, by the third film, by Phantom Thread, he was like, you're never going to use this song. I said, mark my words, I'm going to use it. Of course, never used it. And then this time, he said, this is no way you're going to use this. Finally, I won a bet of getting it in the film. So I was thinking in my mind when you asked that question, like, there is something I have wanted to, and I wanted to use it so I could win a bet. Because I didn't have any, like, I don't know, if I was making a film about when I was this age, that would sort of be more the late 70s or early 80s, and I could probably make a list of 10 songs right now that would instantly flash me back there. So I was thinking more along the lines of, well, what's going to be right for the story?
Yeah.
Never reaching to sort of find. But as anybody knows, that California radio is very different than most other radio, you know? And it's better, as everyone knows. Everyone assumes they know.
It's always been my dream to be on California radio, maybe one day.
Right? Really?
Yeah.
There's something about it.
So great.
I know.
Yeah. I've done some road trips. My cousin lives up in Mammoth.
Yeah.
And so we kind of do the drive we go out every 2 years and we do that drive through the Mojave up.
Yeah.
And I just love almost kind of the different, you know, the reach of those stations isn't very far.
That's right.
So every time you kind of leave one, you join another. And I like that kind of almost kind of little really you get of the different sounds as you move away from this ocean as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
Into that Sierra Nevada way. It's really interesting.
I know. It's like... Yeah, it's something like, it's as if the state and the radio stations evolved at the same time, like from primordial ground. they've always been here. They've always been here. These mountains and this radio station, it is true. They're so intertwined, the kind of California radio and that thing. It's unlike anything else in the rest of the country, really. There's something about it in California is magical. But as you know, obviously the obvious reasons behind that is obviously we spend so much time, it's so big, we spend so much time in our cars, a disproportionate amount of time in our cars, that's our soundtrack to our life.
Yeah. The companion.
Yeah, completely. Yeah.
Well, it's great because in the film, there's so many little musical kind of moments, whether it be the radio stations that you hear, you know, or the broadcaster on the radio or the little clips of music, or when he goes into the restaurant and she shows up for the first time and I Left My Heart in San Francisco is being played on the piano in the background and things like all these just tiny little moments that just are just there, but
right
But yeah, I mean, with things like that, what's the kind of choice?
Well, wait, because you're making me think. Okay. I didn't even get your question out because this isn't so important, is that because it actually answers your question for it. So I Left My Heart in San Francisco is not the most important thing. The most important thing there is Johnny Guarnieri. Johnny Guarnieri was a stride piano player who played every, I think, Wednesday, maybe Thursday night at Tail of the Cock restaurant, which is where I, you know, it was the fanciest restaurant in Sherman Oaks. You know, if it was Mother's Day or if it was a special birthday or your grandmother's birthday, you would go to Tail of the Cock. And Tail of the Cock, so we would go Wednesdays as well because my dad loved music, jazz music in particular.
Yeah.
And so Johnny Guarnieri performing was this really special thing every Wednesday. And I remembered that really well. And there's only a couple Johnny Guarnieri records out there. There's a couple self-published kind of records that we were able to track down and get. And those are cool. That song, I mean, that was a kind of like a reality to base something on. Like, well, wait a minute. I have memories of this guy playing piano and playing it so well. One of my great memories or horrible memories. How much time do we have?
Half an hour. It's great. This is episode one of, you know, of many we can do in the future.
I think it's this Monmouth coffee that's got me. Got me talking too much. There was a scene that we had in the film and we cut it out, and it was based on a memory that I had of one night in Tale of the Cock, this kid who was probably about 11 or 12 years old, and I must have been about the same age at the time, walked up to the piano that Johnny Guarnieri was playing, and he started noodling around as if he didn't know how to play the piano, and then he started playing Chopsticks. Like, dun, 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 you know, this kind of thing. And everyone was sort of looking and they're like, you know, why are we impressed by this? And then he kind of segued gently out of Chopsticks and he started playing The Entertainer, you know, Scott Joplin.
Yeah.
Just playing it very slowly. Dun, 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 right? And sooner or later, this kid is playing The Entertainer at like 400 miles an hour, and the entire restaurant is on its feet, you know, exploding that this 12-year-old kid, 10-year-old kid could play The Entertainer, let alone play it at 1,000 miles an hour. And I just remember everybody finally sitting down and my dad looking over being so disappointed. Like, you see? Now that kid really took his piano lessons.
Oh my God, it's just a flashback of the various moments of disappointment with my own parents of kind of when they see another kid. It's just like, oh. With the asks of Johnny, there was much to ask of him in this film. There was only a few sort of little bits here and there. There's a beautiful piece of music when he asks for her phone number. That's little Johnny Q, isn't it?
That's Johnny.
It's so delicious and hopeful.
Yeah. It was hard to wrap my mind around getting the courage to say to tell Johnny that I didn't really need that much from him. But it was good because, well, it's supposed to be a hopeful movie. It didn't need his sad misery all over it, right?
It's slightly ironic that his new project with Tom's called The Smile Band. It's kind of like my
That's
favorite.
Rich. Yeah.
But no, it has such a beauty. It kind of... You're hoping for them through the music almost in a way.
For sure.
Yeah.
No, for sure. Yeah, joking aside, I mean, he can, whatever the assignment is, he can do it. And there's a hopefulness, but a little bit of caution. And the only idea that I went to him was, I said, I need a little bit of something at the very beginning, and then I needed to repeat and get bigger at the end, you know, but it has to be simple enough, hopefully, that it's recognized with all this cacophony of different music that we're going to have to recall something that was 2 hours ago.
Yeah.
It would be nice in a couple notes that you can remember 2 hours ago, yeah. right? And so that was just the harp, that simple kind of harp line that he came up with. Mm. It seemed like, well, we're not hearing harp anywhere else in the film, which will help. And hopefully this kind of instantly gets you back to that first, you know, it's a very similar shot as well. I think Alana's walking away. They were walking forward, so the camera's pulling back. So you can kind of echo those two things.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was the assignment.
I wanted to ask about, I couldn't work out what it was, whether it was an existing piece of music or it was is when the convention, it's this sonic kind of like overdose of things that you remember, like even the sound of the Batmobile as they walk in sort of thing. And it's like, oh my God, you're instantly kind of transported to being a kid and watching that on TV. And and then John C. Reilly, when he goes, I'm not the real Herman Munster. but this music that's playing in the background, which really reminds me of The Jungle Book.
That's the Chico Hamilton song
that
I was talking
about. Is that the Chico you were talking about? Because it's got that kind of Confide in Me moment from Jungle Book sort of vibe to it. Thing. Oh, I didn't, that's what that is. Okay.
That's what that is. So Chico Hamilton.
Amazing.
Yes. Chico Hamilton came to my attention because Chico Hamilton and his quintet are a big part of the music of Sweet Smell of Success, great film. Elmer Bernstein did the score for that, but Chico Hamilton's band is actually in it.
Oh, wow.
And I loved that film so much, and so that turned me on to them in a big way. We used one of their songs called The Sage in Boogie Nights early on. It was just a great cello piece. Beautiful. Fred Katz was a part of that band, and just a loop over and over again. There's actually a great version. Have you ever seen Jazz on a Summer's Day?
No.
Beautiful concert film. There's a great live version of that in Jazz on a Summer's Day. That's
my day sorted.
really, Mahalia Jackson doing the Lord's Prayer and that. That's a winner.
Okay.
Jazz on a Summer's Day.
When does music start coming into the thought process for, is every film different? You know, do you write to music? Do you have an idea of how you want a film to sound musically? Because every film definitely has its own journey with music. You know, prior to chatting to Johnny, I watched, you know, There Will Be Blood again, and it's just such an incredible relationship between the film, the story, the characters and the music, you know?
Yeah.
Even that opening piece of when the landscape comes back and we kind of see and you're kind of like, yeah. And then the choice not to use music at certain points as well, when he's saying, puts the son on the train. And
yes,
the easy option would have been to put music in there, but you didn't, and it makes it even more powerful.
Right, yeah.
But what's your, is every film different in terms of when you're thinking about music and when you think about music?
Well, they're only different in that they're different stories and there's different approaches, but it does feel, my instinct is to say, no, they're all, yeah, it's all kind of the same because you're all thinking, I guess the difference would be, like, if I'm doing something maybe with Johnny, I have the sense that music should happen here and music that should be up, or music that has a little propulsion or rhythm, or there's something, an opportunity here for something that's kind of more liquidy or less clear. But I don't know what that sounds like, and I don't have it in front of me until he gives it to me. So that you're kind of operating with a little bit of your imagination or voices in your own head. Mm. But it's something else when you're doing a film of pre-existing music already. You can really kind of map out a feeling in a simple playlist. You say, okay, I can kind of really hear this. I can see how this flows. And that's really fun. But I mean, but also, you know, like after a while, that you know, you get demos and things from Johnny. It doesn't, the mystery can kind of, it goes away in a good way, you know, and you're working with, and you're shooting to enough material.
Yeah.
That you can, even if it's just a simple loop of something for 30 seconds, you know, it'll get larger as you keep working on it. Yeah. But in that way, it's always kind of, it's the same and fumbling around and, you know.
Feeling it, isn't it?
Yeah.
Magnolia will always be one of my favorite films ever. I mean, I just love any opportunity to go and rewatch that film, and the voice of Amy Mann in that, within that film and stuff is so... it's like a character in it, you know, in a way, sort of thing. What was the kind of choice of that and the decision behind that being, you know, because, I mean, John Bryan working on it as well, something, but...
I always liked that. I always liked, I mean, I guess you think of The Graduate as an example.
Harold and Maude,
you know, kind of a singular voice. I mean, honestly, not that many years before, Elliot Smith had done stuff for Good Will Hunting. It's a little bit different, but, you know, yeah. But a kind of single voice that belonged to a film was always like, I always liked that. And I had a pretty tight relationship with Amy at that time. So I had all this sort of music.
Yeah.
And that really just was a very organic kind of, you know, thing that ended up happening and working quite well to everybody's advantage. You know, there was sometimes quite... Well, I was going to say it's quite hard to know which came first, but I do know which came first. Sort of a lot more of her music came first than the story. But the stories were sitting around waiting for some trigger.
Yeah.
One is the loneliest number that you'll ever do. Two can be as bad as one. It's the loneliest number since the number one. Experience you'll ever know. Yes, it's the saddest experience you'll ever know. Because one is the loneliest number that you'll ever do. One is the loneliest number that you'll ever know.
Do you write with music? Do you have kind of playlists that you...
Yeah, I think most people... You've had so many people on the show. I wonder what the percentage is of people... Most people say yes.
Most people say yes with regards to writing, but different ways, and that they'll almost kind of try. And some people will have things on that are instrumental that are completely removed from what they're trying to write.
Yeah.
Or who they're trying to write. And then the opposite of that, people will make specific playlists for characters too.
Yeah. I think it's a kind of gift not to be misused or overused. Mm. And what I mean by that is that there's some scenes in a movie you have to write when it's quiet.
Yeah.
Do you know?
Yeah.
I don't know. I feel like you could write a scene listening to music real loud alone in your room and probably end up half writing a scene or half thinking about it or being distracted or swept away by whatever the music is probably doing to you, when in fact you have to think about it, what the soundtrack is to those characters in real life, which is just whatever words they're saying or whatever sounds from outside are happening. So sometimes you have to be careful to do that. make sure that you take the time to do that. I think it's also kind of your whatever your work habits are, really. Sometimes you wake up in the morning and the last thing you want to do is hear anything. Mm-hmm. Or sometimes you wake up in the morning and you're just you have a song that's pumping through your head and you need to hear it. Or at its best, you have, at its most fun is that you have research to do to a certain time, mm-hmm. and it's going to take you to listen to things that you've never heard before, or that's really great.
Yeah.
It's just an excuse. To,
yeah. It's one of the perks of the job.
Know, you're like, yeah. Do not disturb. I'm working. I'm trying. Like, what are you doing in there? Like, I'm listening to music, trying to find some shit I've never heard before, and I'm getting paid for it.
Winning at life.
yeah, I know.
I was listening as well to the score for Punch Drunk Love this morning coming in, and it was lovely to be kind of reminded of that. And you immediately kind of think of those moments in the film, and that really clever thing of having this sort of main theme that is kind of reconstructed different with different musicalities to it. You know, whether it's the sort of French chateau version or the it's a kind of harpsichordy type piano thing as well, sort of thing.
Harmonium. Yeah, there's a, yeah.
But it's so clever. And what do you remember about that film? I mean, I love that film as well.
Well, I remember having so many built-in musical opportunities. In other words, there was this part of the story was this harmonium and this kind of melody line that Adam was going to play. So everything was going to come around that you would have this do-do-do-do-do, five-note, mm-hmm. melody, and that was going to be this kind of main piece of it. You know, I have gone on record so many times of just loving musicals. And at the time, anything George Gershwin was interesting, anything Cole Porter was interesting, those kind of classic kind of American scores. And that felt like what a romance movie mm-hmm. should have, anything that was like that. What you find out later about a lot of those songs is that a lot of them were written so simply because, like, Fred Astaire couldn't really sing. Mm-hmm. Apparently, so he had a very limited range.
Yeah.
So they would keep everything kind of right in this limited...
Almost sing-speak in a way, wasn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. By the beat, beat, beat of the tom, tom, tom. like that's as much as he could do.
Yeah.
Night and day, I can't say it's so humiliating, so you're going to cut that part out, right?
It's like karaoke with Paul, I love it.
But so that a lot of the kind of opportunities for the music were just having to
shrink the limitations
of his ability to sing. So thank God, we're all the better for it. It's beautiful music to me. But anyway, so that's with that. And then also having He Needs Me, the Harry Nilsson thing in the middle of it, with Shelley Duvall. Yeah, it's great.
So great.
And all at once I knew at once, I knew he needed me. Until the day I die, I won't know why, I knew he needed me. It could be fantasy.
That love of that type of music and that kind of period kind of almost kind of carries through to kind of Phantom Thread in a way as well, and how romantic and beautiful that score that Johnny created for Phantom Thread was.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was to look back at it, and I mean, maybe he'll admit it, but it was like, I like Henry Mancini music, but Johnny's not going to really listen to Henry Mancini music unless I put it in front of him and say, come on, put some more Henry Mancini into it. So somewhere that combination of my love of that kind of lush orchestral music, which is not really maybe his favorite thing in the world, mixed in with what he does so well, just ended up being something.
Knockout.
I know.
Yeah.
I still, I can't believe I that's music from a movie that I made. It's still, I think that music that he made for that movie is going to last forever.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
How good it is.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. One quick thing that I wanted to mention as well, which I love, and I love what I love about whenever I read interviews with you, is just how much you love film. You know, it's not about you're into a type of film. You really embrace and celebrate all types of film, and I love that. And I'm a massive Adam Sandler fan, and I was so happy when you said Big Daddy sealed the deal for you on Adam Sandler, because I love that film Scooby Steve. And you know, and I remember one of the first times I went to New York after that, I did a kind of Big Daddy like kind of
tour
of like when he pissed against the wall outside the restaurant and all that kind of stuff. And I was just kind of like, man, I love the fact that it's kind of, you know, you celebrate film, whatever it is. It's not about it having to be, you know, independent, you know, film. It's about celebrating performances, storytelling, all that kind of thing, which I think is brilliant and quite unique, I think, as well.
Yeah, I mean, I mean, thank you. I hope so. I mean, I like what I like, I guess. And it's like, if it gets me going, it gets me going. I don't have any. So, and it would be too hard to be snobby, because you just get it where you get it anything where you can. You know, you come across something that maybe you have a snobbiness, you think, well, what's all this? And then your eyes can get open to something great. So I don't know. I always try to sort of be open. But I don't know. I do enough time rolling my eyes sometimes too. what is happening? You know?
I love how much as well you've loved some of the films from this year as well that have come out, as well as your own Worst Person in the World being one of them.
Yeah.
Wow.
What a soundtrack too.
Oh my God. Yeah. I was listening to, so it's an existing music, isn't it? And I was one track I was listening to on repeat last week. I can't remember what it's called now, which is slightly annoying, but it's just this beautiful piano piece, really simple.
There's so many.
I'm going to have a look, see what it was.
Yeah, take a look, because let's use our cheating devices to see. There's so many pieces of music. I mean, the Todd Rundgren I had heard before, but not in a million years. And that was great, incredible use of that in the film. There's a Harry Nilsson song he uses as well, Which one are you thinking of?
It's the is he like an Icelandic?
Yeah, see, there's lots of that kind of stuff that was so not on my radar.
Yeah,
that...
me too. And it's been around for ages. Mm-hmm. And I didn't Otto or Totland.
Which one? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Literally, yeah. Like, floored me, like, yeah. Really stopped me in my tracks. I think I listened to it 25 times on repeat.
Yeah, that's been in the car on the way to school every morning in my house.
It's a good mood setter.
It's great. You can either if it goes down a little too much, skip to the next one and bring you up. It's got a really nice variety in there. But yeah, my daughter and I have been listening to that one on repeat.
Yeah, and you mentioned Titan as well. The Julia Ducournau film, which is mental, and I've never felt so physically affected by a film and kind of scared and not really sure how to talk about it.
Did you see it in the theater?
I saw it in the theater, and then I spoke to her actually about it. She was amazing.
Yeah, she sure is.
She's exciting.
I don't know how to speak about that film either, so I just try to sort of sidestep conversations about it.
Just watch it is what I say to people.
Well, the thing I remember thinking, it was kind of one of the first films I was able to go back to a theater and see. And I was very happy that I saw it in a theater because as much as I – look, we can talk about how supportive I am of films. It's like I know myself that I might have blinked if I was watching that film at home. And I might have said, I'm not going to do this right now.
Yeah.
You know, fair enough. But in a theater, I had to sit there. I had to take it. Like a man, you know, like come on.
Yeah.
And I was better for it, you know, once you kind of work through the things that she's putting out there. And I guess that's one of the great joys that I still get from seeing a movie is the inability to speak about it is a lot more exciting to me than fucking piss off. I don't know.
The cinema, it's the importance of cinema as well, as one of the many things that highlights how important the cinema as a building and a place is.
Well, sure.
Theatre to go and watch. Because it takes you somewhere else that watching something at home, you're kind of like, it's a cop-out in a way.
It is a cop-out, but it's also, I don't know, I think I liked what I liked about that movie. You said it initially, and it's like bears repeating. It's like that inability to speak about something makes it mysterious. And it's like are we gonna sit? You want to have a conversation about 2001? I don't. I don't want to have to try to describe of the feelings that I get from it.
Yeah,
because it's too many words. It's a waste of time. It's like I felt it.
Yeah,
and that's I don't know. I'm one of those people that would prefer, certainly with many films that I really enjoy, to not talk about them.
Yeah,
or just be like. You know, it's enough to say like, yeah, it's fucking great. You should see it.
Yeah. Like, sometimes that's back. Enough.
Yeah.
We've run out of time. But
no.
I hope this is the first of many that we can do because there's so much more we could talk about. I had a list the length of my arms.
What
without
didn't
my
we get to?
Boogie Nights.
Okay.
We talked a little bit about Magnolia. I mean, we didn't really get into much about Phantom Thread really or...
Yeah.
But so there has to be a revisit part two, I hope.
Yeah.
Maybe when you come back to pick up all those awards you're going to win, you can we can get another one. So happy for you. This film's just connected though on that level. It's so deserving.
Yeah.
From the director, but also for the screenplay as well. This is a great story.
Yeah. Thank you.
It's such a great story. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks, Paul.
Are you kidding?
Thank you so much.
Anytime.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah.
Soundtrack to Boogie Nights, that's Machine Gun by the Commodores, which features in one of my very favourite scenes, and producer Ben's, and rounds off our latest episode with Paul Thomas Anderson. I've set myself a challenge to try and reenact the dance on my TikTok channel. So check it out, see if I've managed to do that. My huge thanks to Paul for taking the time to talk to us. It was a genuine delight to get to sit and talk to him, and I could have done that for absolute hours. He is so in demand and he didn't have to give us his time, and he did so generously. So I am so grateful for that. So yeah, thank you, Paul. Licorice Pizza is still available to watch in cinemas. So go get yourself along to a showing on the big screen if you can, and just relish in Paul's world and also the brilliant performances of Alana Haim and also young Mr. Hoffman, Cooper Hoffman, who, oh, please just continue this journey, Cooper, because you are mesmerizing to watch. Head to edithbowman.com to catch up with all of our previous episodes, including my chat with the aforementioned Johnny Greenwood. And you can follow us on Twitter, Instagram and Facebook. We are at Soundtracking UK. As I said, Craig Roberts is coming up in a couple of weeks, but next week we have the fantastic talents of Domi Shi and Lindsay Collins, who are the director and producer of the new Pixar film Turning Red, which I think is one of the best Pixar films in many, many years. It's been scored by Ludwig Göransson, and I'm very excited to have Domi and Lindsay on the show next week. I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then.
Has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including Eastern and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Your child deserves an education that sets them up for success. K-12 knows that learning isn't one size fits all and has options tailored to each child's needs, interests, and goals for the future. K-12 powered schools are tuition-free, accredited online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. Students learn at their speed, at home, from state-certified teachers specially trained to teach online. Join the more than 3 million families who've chosen K-12. Go to k12.com/podcast to enroll today.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.